Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds. To boldly go where no one has gone before.
Engage.
Enterprise, Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
This is Captain Jonathan Archer.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
Yes, it is the next episode of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. I am your host, Jordan Hoffman. Thank you for tuning in once again. Thank you for liking us on Facebook. Oh, for the love of God, like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. Today is a special day. We have with us in the studio, on the battle bridge of Deck 44, Texas's favorite son, John DeVore. John DeVore, say hello.
Hi, Jordan. How are you?
It's nice to see you.
I don't know if Texas would admit to me.
But you do nothing but admit to it. You love Texas.
I have a complicated relationship with Texas. Mm-hmm. I am what you call an ethnic Texan. I was raised by devout Texans outside of Texas. And in a way, I was kind of raised to regard Texas the way I imagine some Jewish people are raised to regard Israel. Texas is the promised land.
Yeah.
And I will one day return to it dead or alive. but I have this and it's, you know, and I used to, and it's funny that you bring up Texas out of the game. The way I explain Texas to non-Texans,
yeah,
is that they are American. They are America's Klingons. Texans are America's Klingons. They are a feisty, yeah, fight happy warrior people.
Yeah.
And Americans outside of Texas always like to make fun of Texans, and especially, you know, Northerners love to make fun of Texans. But when there's a war,
yeah,
America needs Texans, because they're always the first in line to be like, well, we got to go kick some ass.
Right.
So yes, I am an ethnic. I have a complicated relationship with Texas.
I thought you were born and raised. There's so much.
I was not. My father worked for a Texas politician, and I am technically a Beltway brat. My siblings were all either, you know, raised, spent the majority of their lives in Texas, but I was raised in the Beltway by devout Texans, and it was like, you know, we were strangers in a strange land.
Right, right.
You know, nothing in the D.C. area was as good as Texas.
Sure.
There was nothing that good. So, again, you know, and I spent summer in Texas. And,
yeah,
and of course, you know, my mom is Mexican-American.
Which is more Texan than Texas.
It is.
For a mom, anyhow.
Look, I've accepted that in, my great-great-great-great-great-granddad on my mom's side went to bed in Mexico and one day woke up in Texas. Texas is
that was the transporter involved.
He's just like one night he's like, good night, Mexico.
Right.
And the next day he's like, where did all these white guys with cowboy hats welcome to Mexico? And they were like, you mean Texas? So again, very complicated. Very complicated.
Yeah. All right. Well, the I'm glad you brought up politics, because the reason we have John on today, John, for those few of you who don't know, is an award-winning essayist.
That's right.
Writer, columnist, radio personality from Sirius XM.
Long time ago.
Back when Sirius and XM, before they merged, right?
Right during the merger, which is...
They realized when they merged they had to cut costs, so they hired you instead of two other people.
No, they hired me before the merger, and then they merged, and they were like, well, we can let go of the fat. They were like, you know, it was a fascinating time to be part of that merger.
Right.
And Sirius was great. It was a great experience.
Those of you who watch late night cable news may recognize John's voice. He has been a... Come on, I'm trying to build you up here. Has been a...
try hard.
Has been a guest on Fox News as sort of the sacrificial lamb liberal.
Yeah.
How many visits have you done?
Maybe I used to... my God. Let's see here.
Give me a ballpark figure.
You know, probably 8 or 9 years I did it on and off. Various shows, predominantly their late night clown show, Red Eye.
Yeah.
And then an assortment of other. But I just would go on for years. And again, the son of a political operative, a Democrat, I used to love to go on.
Yeah.
You know, for years and years, I did a lot of political satire. I once ran a site called, or I co-created a site called WhiteHouse.org.
Right.
With
which confused ants all for years.
Right. It was the brainchild of my friend John Wooden, and for the entirety of the Bush presidency, we tormented him with a site that we designed to look like the White House, but was in fact a grotesque. It was vulgar. It was proper satire. It was grotesque. Yeah. It was ugly. The vice president tried to shut it down.
Really?
Yes. He sent his lawyer, David Addington, who would one day become White House legal counsel.
This is Cheney you're talking
yes,
about.
Yes. Yeah. Cheney sent the man who would one day create the legal framework for torture to send John.
They decided to cut their teeth on you.
To send John Wooden not a cease and desist. It was a wonderful letter. This letter that basically said, "Hey, you should shut your parody down, or else." and the ACLU, I mean, it was going to become a big thing.
Yeah.
And then that's why we invaded Iraq,
because they felt that they had to save face.
You know, eventually it was going to become a story, but then the war started.
Right. Oh,
that's
okay.
What happened.
All right. All right. Too bad.
So anyway, I love politics.
Yeah,
I love partisan politics.
So,
and also, though, being part Klingon, you know, I grew up with a lot of conservative friends. I really call myself a Texas Democrat.
Right. Which just means you like to shoot yourself in the foot. Hey.
That's pretty good, Jordan. That's a pretty funny joke. So I'm used to conservatives.
Yeah.
To a certain degree, sane ones.
Yeah.
I enjoy the horse race. I enjoy the debate. I enjoy the talking.
But do you enjoy it as much this year? Because it seems I want to frame this. By the way, we are recording this the morning of the presidential election right now, and we are going to release this as we normally do. You know, I like to think of each episode of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast, as living in perpetuity, as a message in a bottle, much like
for the future.
Yeah, much like the episode where the Doctor was discovered in a program centuries beyond Voyager.
Oh, that was a nice episode.
Yeah, I like to think of each episode as living on. But today we have a little bit of a timestamp because while we release these on midnight, Wednesday mornings, late Tuesday night on Eastern Standard Time, and by the time that happens later tonight, one of the two candidates will probably be given the
right.
the nod.
Either Jill Stein or Gary Johnson will be president of these United States.
I got to talk to you about Jill Stein. So late last night.
I can't. No. Don't make me talk about Jill Stein.
No. I just discovered that she was in a folk rock band in the 90s. No, and it's not that bad.
Really?
Yeah, they were called Somebody's Sister, and she is the co-lead singer. It's her and a dude named Ken something or other, and I swear to God, it's all on YouTube. In the 1990s, they put out 4 albums, and as far as, like, opening acts for the Indigo Girls go...
Right.
It's not some of the lyrics.
Wait,
are...
is it Indigo Girls? Because that is high end for
no,
me.
No, I'm saying
is it like more, or is it like Lilith Fair second stage,
fourth stage, all Lilith right. Fair fourth stage. All it's right. it's, but it's not incompetent.
Okay,
they were.
I like that genre of 90s.
Yeah, it's very earnest. Like it's got jangly guitar,
yeah.
nice harmonies.
I like that.
Some of the lyrics are a little bit like about voting. You know, so it's a little bit on the.
Well,
nose.
You gotta, you know, in the 90s we used to rock the vote.
Right, yeah. Well, they would folk rock the vote. And I tell you, if you go to YouTube and Somebody's Sister, there was one song that was just called Boston or Streets of Boston.
Yeah.
And I said, this is not this is like, if you have it on the back, if you had it on the background and didn't tell anybody, and it was on low enough that it couldn't be heard too well, nobody would say anything. They're like, oh, John's listening to some, you know, there are a lot of bands. Some Indigo Girls opening act. Downy Mildew. Remember the band Downy Mildew?
I do not.
I had a few of their albums.
God, sing some.
I will not. But I used to like them because they came around. I saw them live. And they were, it's men and women.
If I had known this,
right.
I might have changed my vote this morning when I was standing in line at 6 a.m. in Brooklyn.
Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, who's a real hoot. But let me ask you a question about politics because you seem to know a lot
about
it.
I would love to.
They always say the third parties the day before, because I do not like Donald Trump, obviously, because I'm a human being. But I do think
he's the most anti-Trek.
Oh, well, do you know about Trek against Trump?
Well, that makes complete sense. But he is the nightmare villain. Trek villain.
He's Gold Ducat. He is Gold Ducat with a red stupid baseball hat. So I'm not a fan of his, but I do think that a lot of other countries, you know, really, really sane political places that have it all figured out, like Israel, for example.
Yeah, right.
but what a stable
right.
Places like that, and Britain and Europe in general.
Yeah, have England, that's some good examples there.
Other countries have multiple political parties.
Nah, in a parliamentary system. But we don't have a parliamentary system.
Yeah, but don't you think that America would benefit from multiple parties?
No, look, it's also a misunderstanding of what the American political parties are. We have third parties and fourth parties and fifth parties. These parties are alliances of smaller groups and self-interests.
You're talking about wings within the party?
No, I'm saying that our modern political, you know, our system of government is a winner take all. There's a majority and a minority, and the majority and the minority are comprised of all kinds of other political interests and caucuses and groups and smaller groups. We have tons of parties. The KKK is a third party. It just so happens this time around they have joined one of the major political parties in full, practically.
Right.
So this idea that we have two parties and that there are these outliers is not true. We have outlier parties. They're just so out there, they cannot find consensus within the larger alliance.
But don't you think,
for instance, the Republican Party right now is largely an alliance between rich people and the Hills Have Eyes. The Democrats are more like the Federation of Planets. You got some Vulcans, you got some Andorans, you got Brooklyn.
You got some Ferengis in there too.
You got big, eventually the Klingons, the Texans are there.
Right.
But I just think it's a misunderstanding because I like our system of government because there are ways to stop power, right? But if you're the majority, there are ways to really take the football and run.
I see what you're saying. So you do not bemoan the fact that, forget Gary Johnson and Jill Stein for a moment, but the Green Party and the Libertarian Party and perhaps other parties, the fact that they're not substantially on any tickets doesn't bug you.
No, it does not bother. Because they're
too fringe to wield power?
Right. That's not to say... And I am not an expert on the Green Party's platform, but you know we have elected out of nice balsa wood. We hopefully will elect a party whose platform has incorporated some very powerful language about climate control more so than has been in. That's just the way.
Yeah.
This works. It's a messy grind. You know, I think a lot of people were very disappointed internally during the Democratic primaries. But like, you know, these were multiple alliances at war with each other who had lots in common trying to figure out how to create a functioning consensus.
I think that's one thing about Sanders' run is that, at least in theory, he maybe yanked Clinton a little bit to the left.
Yes, but that's because Bernie Sanders represented and still represents a large group of progressives.
Yeah,
and they all found a consensus, and part of the mass compromise was a move to the left. And we'll see in the next 4 years if Hillary Clinton is elected. We'll see in the next 4 years if it's a legitimate move to the left, and then we can go from there.
Yeah.
Well, whatever the left means anymore, just a caveat, because a lot of these terms, progressive, liberal, conservative, they've all been blown up, and we'll see what that means.
Yeah. Well, I'm skeptical, but we'll see. But we'll see. But so, John, you're a pop culture aficionado.
I am. Pop culture junkie.
You love Star Trek.
I do. I love it.
You probably, as a great writer, an award-winning writer, have a great desk where you sit and create your masterpieces. Do you work in one specific place or do you move around?
Oh, absolutely. If you're a writer, you have to have a space to work. And I think all writers, too, are a little superstitious. They need a space where they can be creative.
Right. So what you need on your desk looking at you are some of the great emblems of pop culture. And what you need are expertly crafted models of the various starships from Star Trek. Now, luckily, John, for you.
Me?
Yes, there is a company called Eagle Moss, and they make what's called the Star Trek Starships Collection. It is the only licensed modeling company which makes these little doodads, these little goo-gaws. And they come.
I love doodads.
Yeah, it's a club. You join it, and for twice a month, you get a new one in the mail. And at first, you think, they got the Enterprise. Sure. All right. They got Voyager. Great. How deep can it go?
Defiant,
top level. You get all that. There's like a 75 of them waiting for you. We're talking every ship that ever showed up on the show. Some of them were only on for like a fraction of a second. There's the Enterprise J from the episode of Enterprise when Archer went into a possible future for like a minute and there was a picture on the wall of what the Enterprise J might look like. That's in there. Harry Mudd's shuttle is in there. They got stuff from the movies, stuff from the shows, and it's a club. And it comes, they're beautiful. They come on a little thing. You mount it, you put it on the shelf, and it comes with a nice, not like a pamphlet or a leaflet, it comes with a magazine with nice colors, nice photos. It's a great thing. And so if you go to st-starships.com/engage, st-starships.com/engage, you sign up. The first one's only $5. You get the Enterprise D, you get a little magazine, and then every 2 weeks you get the new one. The price goes up after that. That's not going to lie about that. But remember, caveat emptor, like I said earlier. But this is a great product.
I love Latin.
This is a great product. And the Romulan Warbird, you name it. So if you're a fan and if you like collecting things, and if you're a little bit obsessive because you want them all.
And if you like to have space battles on your desk.
Borg Cube, Borg Sphere. You got them both.
You got both Borgs?
Borg Cube, Borg Sphere, shuttlecrafts, the Galileo.
That sounds awesome.
But they are the real hook is the quality. Very detailed, hand-painted, no joke. So that's Eagle Moss, st-com. No, st-starships.com/engage. Sign up today. Yeah, I forgot what I was going to say.
We were talking about the election. You know, that's today.
That's today. Well, no, I'm a little bit.
You know, so, Jordan, it's only probably one of the most historical days in our lifetime.
Right. No,
that's today,
now. So it's a little bit. It's a little bit freaky, and I'm just curious. Do you think, let's say, Donald Trump gets elected, because it could happen. Here are the two.
Sure, sure.
Let's throw the two reasons why
it's possible.
Because nobody predicted Brexit. All the polls said Brexit's not happening, and then the morning of, don't worry about Brexit, and Brexit happened. And number two is, and this is something that my source on this is not exactly trusted. It's a fellow by the name of Michael Moore, and though I may like his tailor, he is a bit of a clown.
I like to think of you as a younger, sexy.
He's a bit of a clown, but he did say this, that the morning of the primaries in Michigan, which is a key state, Hillary Clinton was up anywhere between 9 and 22 points the morning of, and then she lost to Bernie Sanders that day. So, now that you've heard those two terrifying facts, if Trump is elected president, we do have something in this country called the checks and balances.
All right.
It's not a total. We're not the Romulans. We're not the Cardassians. It's not a total totalitarian state.
Well, it depends. I think the best projection is that the Senate splits 50-50. And Democrats pick up, I think it's like maybe 14 seats in the House, but that's still maybe, I it's off the top of my head, that's still a 30 seat or so majority for the Republicans.
Yeah.
So then the question, if Trump were to be elected, the question is, what is his relationship to the House and Senate?
Yeah.
How much of a green, what's the word?
Stamp of approval. Green light.
Well, right.
Rubber stamp.
Rubber stamp. Thank you. How much of a rubber stamp they'll give their president? Mm-hmm. You know, the Democrats had a crazy primary. I think they're stronger because of it. The Republicans have an even crazier primary, and I'm not entirely sure that they are going to heal anytime soon.
Well,
one of the many X factors that is driving pollsters crazy and making the numbers go crazy is the Republicans demographically are a smaller party, but a loyal party. They show up to vote. We don't even know how many, because keep in mind, 55 million Republicans did not vote, 55% of Republicans did not vote for Trump in the primary.
Right.
So how many of these Republicans aren't going to show up?
Well, you know,
One
thing that I'm thinking of is they may hate him now, but if he wins, they'll love him real quick.
Well, look, everyone loves a winner and everyone loves power. But that's also, but here's the thing too, that Trump supporters should have considered as well. You know, if you're a conservative, a social conservative, and you are anti-choice, and you believe that the government should set up little tiny police precincts inside the uterus of every woman, if you're one of those people who thinks Uncle Sam should tattoo property of the U.S. government inside women's genitals, if you're one of those reasonable people, there is no evidence that Donald Trump, a lifetime supporter of Planned Parenthood, is going to support your views in the White House.
No, particularly because he's not beholden to any of those people because he finances his own campaign.
So in an alternate reality, in a Star Trekian alternate reality, Donald Trump exploits all of the weaknesses in our manifold institutions, gets to be president, and produces a golden age of liberalism, of liberal capitalism, where it's free abortions for all. We're friends with Russia.
That would be the ultimate O. Henry ending. Is that because a lot of the Republicans have been like, no, he's a Democrat in disguise. He only joined this party because it was useful to him.
He has exploited weaknesses in the primary and in the media, and there's no reason to think he has not exploited those weaknesses in the Republican Party, and I'm not even going to say he shouldn't. If there are weaknesses in the system and someone comes along and exploits them, it's the system's fault. One of my arguments against Trump, not that it matters anymore either way to conservatives, is that I don't think there's any evidence that he will represent your interests.
I think his only interest is himself, really. I mean, I know that sounds very trite, but I don't think any of it's thought too well through for him. And
I will be kind as we do a postmortem on the election. You know, he's it's fascinating. Without any support, really, in these parties, let's be honest, they are two of the most powerful organizations in the history of the world.
He toppled it.
He
came like he was a conqueror, and he came in and saw a fortress and somehow got a scaffolding over the wall and toppled the Republican fortress.
And who knows? We could be listening to this tomorrow, and I could be weeping. I know it is like noon or whatever right now.
Yeah.
I don't even know what projections are. I know what the polls say.
Yeah, yeah.
If he were to become president, my Lord, it's like people tomorrow are going to be wearing shoes on their heads and hats on their feet. I'm going to run up and down Sixth Avenue naked. It's going to be just kooky.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage, the official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
Well, we put a very interesting timestamp on this conversation. Luckily, it will be moot soon, and I think that it'll go the way that reason dictates. But I tell you, like you said, it's a really interesting time.
It is. Now, we need Star Trek more than ever.
We do. We need the new show soon. It's coming.
No, I just
in
mean
May.
Star Trek as a philosophy.
We do. We need that.
I can't wait for
the new show, Star Trek Discovery.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
STD.
It's not called that. Not STD. That's a big. That's my job is to make sure people don't call it STD.
I know. That's why I looked you right in the eye.
Although you can't.
That's why I looked you right in the eye and said, well, and I had a little dialogue. I was like, yeah. Well, John, yeah. He's the host and has responsibilities.
Right.
You, on the other hand, have none.
Right, right.
I can't wait for it.
Yeah.
I can't wait for it. I can't wait for it.
Well, you can call it STD, but I just want to let you know that there is a precedent not to call it STD. Every previous Star Trek show has never been ST whatever.
I always thought that was just fan speak.
No, it's legit. I mean, there is something called the Star Trek Encyclopedia, which is the official canon Bible, which was written by Denise and Michael Okuda, who've been guests on this show. And internally, externally, Star Trek the original series is TOS. Star Trek the Next Generation is TNG. Deep Space Nine is DS the numeral 9. Voyager is VGR. Enterprise is ENT. And the new show, Star Trek Discovery, is DSC.
Oh, look. I love Discovery
yeah.
as a title.
Yeah.
I love it because it says a lot of what I love about.
But when the show is so good that it's catching on, if it's STD that's catching on like an epidemic, okay, that's fine too. You know.
I mean.
Do you know what the new movie.
I can't. Now, I'm looking you straight in the eye, and I just want you to know, such is our friendship.
Yes.
I am nuking every inappropriate thing I want to say. As they dance from ganglia to ganglia, just nuking them. Nuking them.
Very kind.
I love you, CBS.
You've been a Star Trek fan your whole life, right?
I have.
Now, because you are, in addition to a policy wonk and a very
knowledgeable
man.
No, just a pundit, just a talking head.
But there's a difference between a pundit and a wonk.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
That's like a difference between a beta Zed and a bullion, a pundit and a wonk.
I like how you did that. No, yeah. I don't. No, a wonk knows things.
Right. You just have opinions. You have feelings.
Oh, this is media. You don't have to know things to have opinions. And also, just to be sure, while I had a political show on Sirius. I've done a legitimate political talk. I would just go on Fox for years.
Yeah.
And just be like, shrug and be like, love Obama. Obama did beer. You know, I would go on for months and just be like, they'd be like, and John, I'm going to vote for Hillary. And then just get hate. Just wash my hair in hate.
Right.
So I was just a pundit. I know nothing. Nothing. A pundit, I believe, is an Indian term for wise man. And it is one of the sweetest, subtlest jokes in all of media.
Right.
Every person on TV talking
knows nothing.
We're just
because they're too busy talking to learn anything.
We're show people,
right? Right. So you've been on a lot of the different networks. Which one has the best food in the green room? Is MSNBC like very?
You know what?
Granola?
I was on. I did a bit on CBS Early Morning years and years ago. A girlfriend of mine at the time, she and I had gotten into one of the local newspapers. Because we agreed to sign a relationship prenup. It was one of those great, like, New York tabloid non-story things.
Yeah.
And so CBS was like, do you knuckleheads want to come on and have a legitimate conversation?
What was in the prenup? Like, who gets to keep it?
It was just
it was a joke.
It was just to make people go, to make married people go, what?
Yeah.
And so CBS had us on in the morning network.
Yeah.
We made network.
Yeah.
To come on and talk just about this dumb thing.
Right.
And my one memory from it, other than they did not do my hair the way I wanted to, they made it look very flat, was what a delicious spread. Because I was like, one of the differences between.
Fresh lox.
One of the differences between. You're right.
Yeah.
Between network and cable is proteins. cable TV, no protein.
It's
CNN?
Just starch.
CNN?
Yeah.
Just carbs. Yeah. Fox News? Ha, Jesus. Fox is a great organization because they are not – they're not a great – they can be. It's complicated. But they are a frugal organization in many ways. They are no frills. They get it done, you know. And so their green room offerings are modest.
Skittles.
They're modest.
Right.
They're modest. They do not. One of my experiences. Fox does not put on airs.
Yeah.
In many ways. Conservatives.
Right.
CNN, a little bit better.
Sure.
A little nicer.
Yeah.
A little better.
Yeah.
They're like, we got real, you know, we got the big building
bananas,
here in Columbus Circle.
Maybe,
well, they're CNN.
Apple.
We gotta be global.
Right,
you know,
right.
But I, you know, or but it could also have been my station. Maybe
right.
If I was like somebody.
Yeah.
There's a like hot and cold buffet.
Well, you say
green room,
Fox is frugal. You're not telling me Hannity gets lox on his bagel, right? I mean, he's a big wig, right?
I don't know if Hannity eats bagels these days.
Oh, I see what you're saying. All right, listen. Okay, so
is he on CBS Radio?
No,
no,
I don't.
I didn't
so.
Know. I have no idea.
So I was saying, not in addition to being a political pundit.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've been writing about entertainment and for years.
I have been a film critic.
Yeah.
And I've written. I recently for. The New York Post's streaming site Decider. I wrote a recap of the last season of Game of Thrones.
Right.
Every recap was me losing my mind because I couldn't believe at this stage of my career I would be writing a fucking recap. So if you want to read what is both an excellent recap
right.
and an egotistical culture writer brought low having a panic attack... Every yeah. recap, every episode
right.
is me losing my mind.
So which character...
Decider.com, that's where you can find them.
Which character did you see yourself most as? As Reek, I would imagine, right? I mean, was that...
Yes, yeah. yes. Before I began to write the recaps,
yeah, you were
I auto-castrated.
No, you were Theon when you walked in, you were Reek yeah, when you came out.
That's exactly right.
Wow.
Yes, I've written about... and you know, I worked in men's magazines for years
yes.
and would cover the geek beat.
Yes. So the geek beat being your love of Star Trek is
yes.
not just a small thing in your world. You were
no,
telling me earlier that when you saw Wrath of Khan in the theater, this was a big moment for you.
It was, I think we're about the same age.
I was
29. I'm at that age
yeah.
where I make that joke,
yeah.
and I just think it's the funniest thing. I just think it's the funniest thing. I was carded
yeah.
when I bought my Nicorette. and I gave the nice person my ID and
yeah.
I'm like, I'm only 22. And she was just like, I've heard that joke before. So I was ground zero for Star Wars.
Yeah.
Right? Just generationally. And what I knew about Star Trek was that my grandma, my Mexican American grandma, loved it. She
yeah.
loved it. But I, you know, and I remember going to see the Star Trek, the movie, and being underwhelmed.
Yeah.
Because it's like watching it again. It's a very cerebral movie.
It's very good, but it's not for kids. It isn't.
Although, I rewatched it recently, and they really were pioneering in the use of giant... malevolent cloud monsters. since then,
yeah.
Hollywood is like, when they can't really decide on who the villain
oh,
is,
yeah.
they're like, a malevolent cloud sounds
sure.
about good. A lot of purple.
The Silver Surfer movie had a cloud.
That thing.
Green Lantern
worst.
Had a cloud.
Recently, I love Doctor Strange until we get to the cloud at the end.
It wasn't a cloud.
It was a cloud with a face.
It was the Dread Dormammu. What do you...
Cloud with a face. Talking Death Cloud.
He was a Talking Death Cloud.
Right, thank you.
A confused Talking Death. What?
So then I go and see The Wrath of Khan.
Right.
Now, let me compare two emotional moments.
Yeah.
Right? You're a kid and you watch Return of the Jedi and Darth Vader saves his son. You know, that was an important moment, especially for a generation that was really reeling from the divorce bloom of the 70s,
mm-hmm.
right? to see your to see you know, and Star Wars is a family saga.
Yes.
To see a father who had been bad
sacrifice himself,
redeem himself. Right. Yeah. It's moving if you're a kid. You love your dad. You know, and especially if you have a complicated relationship with your dad. What a moment. When Spock sacrificed himself for the for the many.
Yeah.
It really hit me, and I was at a point in my life because where it hit me, where, you know, I was probably, God, you know, 10, 9, 10, 11. The idea that, and then I would discover this idea later in my life, the idea that you would die for a friend, that a friend is as close as family, that you would sacrifice yourself for somebody who isn't, for somebody who you have chosen to be with, because right. family you can't choose, was just a hell of an emotional moment for me as a little kid. And it's one of the things that I love about Star Trek. And again, Star Trek's it's very cerebral. It's a technologist's dream, utopian dream, all these wonderful things. Mm-hmm. But it's also about a tin can with a family that's not related with each other, kicking around the universe.
Right.
And that was just it was just this crazy moment for me to consider that you would. That you would sacrifice yourself for someone who is not your own blood.
Right, right.
You know, and I even found that moment when he neck pinches Bones to be poignant.
Sure.
Because he knew that his friend would not let him do
right.
that.
Yeah.
And for me, that was the moment where I got hooked on Star Trek. It wasn't the opera or the effects or the very smart science fiction, which I would come around to later.
Yeah.
The emotional core of it, and it's something that I love about Westerns too. You know, I'm an enormous fan of Star Trek and Lonesome Dove, which I call Texas Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, Lonesome Dove is big. Yeah.
I love Lonesome Dove. And Lonesome Dove, like all great
You're talking about the book or the TV show
both,
or both?
Both. Yeah. And you know what? And I'll connect it all too, because obviously Star Trek has that kind of cowboy frontier thing that was the fashion in the 60s.
Sure, yeah.
My favorite aspect of Westerns is this idea that you go off, you explore, and the only way you can survive in a hostile land is the love and loyalty you have with your companions, your friends, your non-family. But that, to me, was the thing that looped me into Star Trek. And so when I got older and I began to watch Star Trek The Next Generation,
yeah.
you know, the friendship and loyalty between Picard and Riker, the very father-son relationship between two people who are not related, just the family aspect of it.
You see Picard and Riker as father-son, not colleagues?
I see it's a great relationship because there's obviously respect.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is this, I mean, he is a paterfamilist,
yeah.
Picard is a father figure in the best sense. He's not patronizing. I don't think he looks at his crew as children.
Mm.
But there is a there.
He's the dad that treats their kids like grownups. I'm going to treat you like a grownup. If you want to be treated like one, you have to behave like one.
Riker, there are various times in the series where he has been offered. Right. Being captain.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's like one of his whole shticks is
right.
that. Why would I choose to be number the first
right.
on a dipshit ship when I can be second in command under the greatest right. captain on the greatest
As
ship?
As Milton said, why serve in heaven?
Right.
And you can raise in hell. But I think that's important to his character.
He's the anti-Peter principle, Riker. He knows that he is best served as second in command on the ship.
Right. He makes a choice.
Yeah.
And he makes a choice. And part of that relationship is that he chooses to defer to Picard.
Yeah.
But it is not blood. It is not family.
Yeah.
You know. And that's a thread through all the series. This kind of family.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's something that is very. I mean, I think that is something that's important to Lord of the Rings. I think it's important to Lonesome Dove.
Sure.
It's important to American pop culture. You know, Friends is about the love of non-family.
Right.
And
the Mystery Machine.
Right. You know.
Are any of the Scooby-Doo Mystery Machines? Are they? Is there brother sister? Is Velma and Fred? Are they related?
No. I mean, no, I don't think they are.
Is Daphne and Fred dating?
I think it's the 60s.
So Fred was dating.
You know
both
what I watched
them?
Recently? Because I had forgotten, because I'm getting into the later episode of DS9.
Yeah.
I completely forgot that Odo and Kira hook up.
They would prefer that you forgot that too.
I wanted to watch that the final awesome arcs.
Yeah.
As we get into this great space opera, great space battles.
Yeah.
It was so good. So good. DS9 might be the series that is the most consistent across all seasons.
It's certainly the most
but the
deepest.
But they were having sex.
Yes, they were. And
why did they do that?
Well, because they needed to give they like to do that in the seventh season. They like to give characters
incest
hookups. I mean, you know, Worf and Troy hooked up, and then Worf and Jadzia. Yeah.
Well, but Worf is great.
But who wouldn't sleep with Worf? But, you know, there is an interesting thing, because Odo's shape as René Auberjonois is just a choice.
Right.
So when the lights dim, Odo can appear as however Odo wishes, or more to the point, however Kira wishes. So I'm saying, you know,
we are making long sustained eye contact, and I would love to jump into this, right. But I want you to keep talking.
No, I'm saying, if you're gonna make love to a shapeshifter,
right?
Like on duty, like during the day. Right.
So if I'm dating a changeling,
if you're dating a changeling, René Auberjonois is a fine pick for like office hours.
Right. But when the lights go down, I can whisper into that changeling's ear
and say,
look like John DeVore.
Right. You can say whatever you want.
Like, I need you to look like John DeVore. That's right. No. John DeVore right now.
I think if you put the closed captions on Deep Space Nine Blu-rays, you'll hear it's whispered that Nana Visitor said that very, very... Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing that is somehow... The only time it ever comes up is there's a moment when Kira and Odo are you know, exploring their love, and Odo, like, appears to her in, like a nebulous, like...
Cloud?
Not so much a cloud, just, like, winking lights. And she's enveloped in sparkles, and her face lights up, and there's definitely a sexual energy to that. And...
That's great, man.
Yeah.
I just
no, but I mean,
I'm going to go back and watch that on Netflix.
But so what is going on in that sequence? And like, you know,
cloud sex.
Yeah, and this was on. I mean, if this was on HBO, who knows what would have happened in that scene?
So yeah, that's how I got into Star Trek. I like it as a tale of
the Old West.
Yes, but of
well, you know how
of friends of you know the love of friends that moment. The whole, all the, you know, like when my father passed away long ago, I would meet all of these old friends, all these old Texans, who wished me condolences, and they loved my dad, and they would all come up to me, gritted teeth, and wish me condolences in that. And choke in the way that beautiful bad actor Shatner chokes when he's given the eulogy over the photon torpedo.
Sure.
Right?
Never met anyone more human.
It's funny, you know, I'm a film critic. I have a wide palate.
Mm-hmm.
That last act in Star Trek II is just one of the finest moments in pop culture.
Yeah.
It just hits, you know, just, it's just a great, it's just so good. And, you know, and it's just, and it's, it, there's just so much going on.
It's really perfect. And what's so great about it is that it's only after you really scrutinize it a lot, you'll realize that it's very low budget. Shatner and Montalban were never in the same room. They only met. They met when they shot Space Seed in the 60s.
Right.
But when they did Wrath of Khan, they didn't meet until like doing press.
That's funny. Yeah.
They just talk to view screens.
They
never see each other. But and, you know, it's
such a it is for me the high watermark. I would put it up there in terms of those 80s spectacles.
Yeah.
Spielbergian spectacles. Nick Meyer, what's his name?
Nick Meyer, yeah.
Right. It's just a tremendous pop culture moment. Regardless of, because, and it's perfect too, because you don't necessarily need to have seen Space Seed or have been a Trek fan.
No, you really don't.
It is one of those movies that transcends its genre. It is a naval movie.
Yeah.
It is about loyalty and friendship and vengeance.
Yeah. In a way, it's a shame it's called Star Trek II because it implies that you need to have seen the others.
Right.
And you really don't. You don't need, like, everybody knows who Kirk, Spock, and Bones are. And Spock is logical and blah, blah, blah. But even if you somehow have been living under a rock and don't know that,
you don't need it.
Yeah.
The emotional fuel.
Yeah.
Is in the movie. You don't need context to ultimately feel for these two old men who are friends and how one of them sacrifices himself so that his friends may live.
Yeah.
It is timeless. We're talking like, you know, Iliad time. You know, it is a timeless sort of story.
Yeah.
And while I love the entire canon, that movie is one of the many instances that it's transcended. You don't need to know any context.
Right.
And
there are
and,
a lot of it's fun, you know, there are a lot of moments in Star Trek that I always think of as classic literature. Episodes that can pretty much live on an island.
I agree. Yeah.
Like the episode The Inner Light, which is you don't really need to know anything about Picard or anything. This is the one where he gets zapped and he lives a whole other life on a planet, but it's actually implanted in his mind.
Yeah, it's a great episode.
There's, you know, the episode The Day of the Dove. It's just, it almost feels like it's like out of the Bible. It's just like, there's a big glowing marble on the ship that's killing people, and it's fueled by hate. So Kirk and the Klingon named Kang, in this case, need to chill and love each other, man, so that the marble will disappear. It's just very, very basic. And it just plays itself out very logically.
There's an episode in Deep Space Nine about an old Klingon warrior.
Yes. Well,
and he...
Blood Oath, it's called.
Is that it? Right.
Yeah. It's and he has to go and fulfill...
I caught that. It made an impression on me. Because I think I just caught that episode on TV way back in the day.
Yeah.
And I had not really, you know, this was the great thing about DS9 is that it kind of really bridged episodic TV.
Sure.
Right. And so I had not really been catching up with DS9. I didn't really know the arcs.
Yeah.
And so I found this one episode about just this old general, this blowhard at the end of his career, trying for one last hoorah with Worf and fighting the Dominion. And it was a great episode. About
you're speaking about there were old warriors, more old Klingon warriors, more than once, because that worked. So they you're speaking about Martok, I think, the guy with one eye. He had one eye. That was the Klingon Martok, because he later.
It was a singular episode.
Yeah. Well, he came back. Well,
No. I don't. Because he dies at the end. It's a Deep Space Nine episode.
All right. Well,
I'll find out.
Just
keep talking.
Are you talking about?
Talk to me again about what it's like for Odo and Kira to have sex, and do it really slowly, because I gotta tell you, I've known you for about 20 years.
Yeah, I guess so.
And I've never seen that color,
such
on
passion.
Your face. I've never seen. You turn such a warm fuchsia. It makes me want to explode into a twinkling cloud.
That's what he did. You know, and there was the other time that Odo's transformation was I don't want to say sexual, but I do want to say biological. It was the time where, you know, Odo has to, he can't maintain his solid form for too long. I forget.
The older you get, you can't.
No, no, you need a pill. So he can't maintain in solid form for, I don't know whether it's 24 hours, 48, 36, whatever it is. So every X amount of hours, he has to relax in a bucket, right? Odo sleeps in a bucket. That's like the joke. So one time, in classic sitcom form, you know, what is it like on every dopey sitcom? They're trapped in a meat locker. They're trapped in a closet. They're trapped in a warehouse overnight, right?
That's right.
You know, and no show did that better than Benson. And, of course, you know, Rene Auberjonois played Clayton on Benson for a zillion seasons.
That's
so.
A great show.
So Odo is trapped in the turbo lift with Loxana Troy, with Majel Barrett, Roddenberry's character, Loxana Troy. And he's like, starting to sweat because he's been solid too long. And he's like, I must decompose into liquid. And she, in a very sort of like mother... So Loxana is like a libertine, right? She's very sensual and sexual, but she's also a motherly figure. So, she's like a space MILF, I guess you might want to call her. So Loxana...
For lack of a better term.
Loxana is like, you may decompose... You may dissolve into me. And she kind of lifts her dress... Right? Kind of lifts it out to catch him. And he just collapses. It's like, bleh! And he dissolves into like this gushy, sloppy slush.
Go on.
In her dress.
Yeah.
And I found this to be one of the weirdest things that ever happened on Star Trek.
You mean erotic?
I don't think it was erotic, but it wasn't not erotic that he just like splashes into her. In like, but it's meant like an I will help you, I will carry you. But it's also like a woman helping a man, like that's having a lot of trouble keeping it together, and it ultimately resolves itself in liquid form. So there's something very strange going on.
We should have just been talking about this since the beginning of the episode.
You know, Brian, we didn't...
I want to know what this episode of Deep Space Nine,
I'm telling you, it's Martok, and he came back. He didn't die.
No, he didn't come back. It's not Martok. He's like it's Worf. Worf has to vouch for a former Klingon hero.
Yeah, that is Blood Oath, then. And Jadzia's in it, too. It's Kor, Kang, and Kodos. Koloth. Kodos. That's Kodos is from Conscience of the King. And Blood Oath, and they go and they attack, and then one of them dies.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's Blood Oath. That's what I thought it was at first.
But it was one of those episodes that, that kind of like,
great.
You didn't need context.
No,
it's the story of old warriors.
Here's what you did.
I love this. I love that because it just came to mind because you were talking about literature and archetypes, and old warriors is something that pops up every so often. Because I like how Star Trek has always had to negotiate its desire for utopian peace with the real politic reality of martial strength.
Well, yes, and that's always, you know, even Kirk. I mean, well, Kirk, you know, it's a Kennedy era cipher was all about that. So
it also that negotiation also produced the greatest line in all of Star Trek.
From which era?
Even Nixon went to China. Possibly.
Right.
Which, you know, not to bring it back to today's political talk, all the stuff, and, you know, because again...
Only Nixon.
I think I said this to a friend as he was trying to negotiate Hillary Clinton's checkered record, let's say, and innuendos. It's like even Nixon go to China. Politics sometimes require. No one's pure.
No one's pure. And the what I was talking about with friends about Hillary Clinton, and you know, I think most people raise an eyebrow, Spock-like, when they really dig into. Yes, she would go to Goldman Sachs and she would have a lunch meeting with maybe 12 people and no recording devices and. Talk as if she has something so wonderful to say to these 12 Goldman Sachs executives and then leave with a $50,000 check. What the hell did she say? The real scandal isn't that she did that. The real scandal is that isn't illegal. Like, what she did is perfectly fine.
Yeah, but, you know, going back to what we're talking about in the beginning, like, if these parties are alliances, having that kind of wealth in your tent.
Yeah.
Is part of the, you know, look.
Right. Yeah, it's fine. It's what you need to do. And they say, well, she shouldn't do it because she wasn't Secretary of State at the time. No, but she knew she would be running for president again. It's totally corrupt, but it's also like, who gives a shit? And like, what is she really going to do? Like, she met 12 Goldman executives, looked them in the eye, and they're like, listen, we're going to need a favor from you someday. And it's like, yeah, if your favor is reasonable, sure, you're going to have my number. If you want me to suddenly do something that's so ridiculous that it can't ever happen, no. I mean,
it's another conversation about, you know, Americans have a very naive is one word for it. Misunderstanding is another word of power and what power is.
Right.
You know, we like to tell ourselves, look, if you're a politician, if you're a senator or a governor, you're having a great time.
Yeah.
You know, money isn't power. It can get you access. It can get you to power.
Right.
But we just have a misunderstanding of what power is.
Sure. And then the other thing is like, you know, the Clinton Foundation. First of all, let's say 50% of all the money in the Clinton Foundation goes to needy people.
Great.
50%.
More than that.
All right. But let's give the Bill O'Reillys and the world, let's say half. So let's say 50%, and the rest of it is for upkeep and whatnot. So you say, okay, so the Clinton Foundation sends Bill and Hillary Clinton to Bahrain to do a speech and then come back, and they cover the costs and they cover the hotel and they cover the meals. To somebody who has never traveled outside of the United States, that's like, oh my God, that's such a scandal. But when you're Bill and Hillary Clinton, the last thing you really want to do is travel. Like, traveling a lot, even in first class, and staying in another hotel, it's a pain in the ass. You got to bring your toothbrush. You got to bring your overnight stuff. You're sitting on a plane. You know, it is, you know, if the money in the Clinton Foundation is, you know, putting them in a nice hotel, they're not impressed by a nice hotel at this point in their lives. That's not going to turn the dial for them and make them corrupt to the point of giving whoever gave money something extraordinary. That's day to day for somebody like this. So,
I agree. And it's two other things too. Like, do the ends justify the means when you're talking about shipping truckloads of medicines to HIV patients in Africa?
Right.
And number two, the Clinton Foundation conversation is really about how we structure charities. Because, you know, there are a lot of charities in this country with, you know, shady... Shady financials.
Yes.
And where the wrong percentages of money go to organization and infrastructure versus actual charity.
It's very hard to know who to give... Like, if you want to give money to charity...
Part of the conversation about the Clinton Foundation, which has a demonstrable record of helping... people in third world countries, especially when it comes to AIDS, they have a verifiable record, but it's a broader conversation. Our charities, even the Red Cross, could probably be run better. And I think, and look, you know, sorry, Clinton Foundation, if you're the sacrificial lamb, it should be a conversation. Because the other thing too that's been revealed with Donald Trump is that, you know, a lot of so-called philanthropists.
Yes.
Right?
Philanthropy
is a beautiful word for, you know, tax evasion.
Right.
So, like, you know, so there's a bigger conversation.
Well, you know,
because when I give money to charity, and I'm, you know, you know, who are we? What are we? You know,
$10 here, $20 here. It's whenever there's a new earthquake, you feel terrible.
Even,
yeah.
You know, when I give even a little bit of money, I think, oh, well, then it is going to children. It is going to the survivors of domestic abuse, and it's a really awful feeling to think, well, maybe why would $9 of my $10 go to something, not go to someone who's hungry or go to someone
who's... Right, it's to maintain the infrastructure of the charity, it's you know...
So that's the conversation.
Right, and I have people in my family that have worked for nonprofits, and... they make a good salary, but they also work hard, you know, and that's, you know, and these are, I have someone in my family who worked for like one of these diseases. Didn't work for the disease, worked for the thing trying to stop the disease.
Right.
And she put her whole life into it and worked really, really hard, but she made a good salary. So, you know, when you're donating to that cause, you know, part of it is that. And that's, you know, that's the way it goes. But then there is a little bit of, I do have a streak of free market libertarianism in me. I have great respect for L. Ron Hubbard. And I feel that...
Was Hubbard a free market?
Well, I respect anybody who...
Starts a business?
P.T. Barnum, L. Ron Hubbard. I respect, part of me, respects...
Capitalists.
And I think caveat emptor is a really important thing. I was one of the first things my grandpappy told me when I sat on his knee was buyer beware, look out, don't be a schmuck, and look somebody in the eye and make sure they're telling you the truth. And if you donate to something without checking under the hood and you get screwed, it's kind of on you, don't you think?
In principle, yes. but that is difficult to do when organizations, you know, transparency is important in capitalism.
Yes.
And we have a system where organizations and businesses can spend more money to prevent you from properly looking under the hood. Like it is tough. Look, a consumer without strong regulation or without a radical transparency, a consumer is more often than not at the mercy of businesses who say, "Trust me."
Right.
You know, and that would go the same with charities or any large institutions.
And people don't always have the time. You're in need and you need a product now.
Look, that is an old trick in politics too. Like you don't want voters to be educated.
Right. What did you think? There was a thing on social media recently that some people were complaining that there was a fraud meme flying around. You don't have to wait online to vote if you want to vote for Hillary. Text Hillary to the number. Do you see this? Text Hillary to 50505.
I've not seen it.
And it was flying around, and then a lot of people on the left were saying this is classic voter suppression. And this preys upon minorities. This preys upon. And I'm like, this preys upon schmucks. Like, I don't. Like, if you're going to fall for that.
I don't. I'm not too hard on people who fall for that. That said, you know, one reason I have high hopes for the Democrats right now is that they have a pretty good get-out-the-vote machine.
Yeah.
Politics is ultimately, with all the fanfare and commercials, it is a ground game. And sometimes you win because you pay people to grab people and drag them to the polls.
Right.
And voter suppression... psychological games, lies, is a cherished, classic
it's a tradition
tool in the American democratic process.
Yeah,
trying to keep the other guy's people from getting to the polls.
Yeah, it's part of the game.
It is part of the game.
The best offense is a good defense.
Now, you know, one thing I, you know, there was a meme going around that the Russians would try to hack this election.
Yeah.
American democracy is a jankety shit show. It is multiple states and counties and districts with all kinds of different ancient scantrons.
Sometimes you scan, sometimes you poke a hole.
You can't hack a system that is a shambling Frankenstein of shitty processes. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of beautiful in a way. But like, you know... lying is part of it. You know, so in that degree, like, you know, if you're gonna but like, you know, it's capitalism. Sometimes you make a buck by lying. Most of the time you make a buck by lying. That's just the system we've agreed on.
I have a weird respect for people who make a buck by lying, but then I ultimately feel like they need to get caught, you know.
But then
when they do get caught, I'm like, F that guy. He should go to jail, but kind of is awesome what he did.
That's the system too.
Yeah. Like L. Ron Hubbard. I'm fascinated by the guy. He wrote science fiction books that nobody would read. And then he realized that he would be making a lot more money.
Keep in mind, you know, what he did.
Yeah.
And that's one of the great things, one of the great points in Going Clear.
Yeah.
Is that Dianetics.
Yeah.
Was an enormous blockbuster in a new post-war book genre called self-help. After the war, 80 million people dead over 10, 15 years, a horror show, unprecedented bloodletting. There were people who were like a little wobbly on religion. What do I look for in this world that would put 80 million people through a meat grinder? And so this genre came up, self-help.
And he
it
saw,
wasn't psychiatry, right.
He saw a niche there.
Dianetics was a genre book, a self-help hit that he just spun and spun and spun into a profitable religion.
Right. That wasn't, there was never a master plan.
No. Self-help is a fascinating, you know, because keep in mind, late 40s, early 50s, psychology is still very much in the dark ages.
Yeah.
Lobotomies and sanatoriums, it's very much in the dark ages. People are having massive crises of faith. Because again, we romanticize World War II, but no, it was civilization eating itself, eviscerating itself, and tap dancing in its guts.
Yeah.
And then the genre came up, self-help. Various people were like, "Here, you know, here's some new visions. Here's new ways to be, new ways to see the world and to be happy and fulfilled."
That's also when the sci-fi boom was.
It was this wonderful confluence of things, but you know, L. Ron Hubbard's first con was creating a book that said, here is a way to be more fulfilled. Here's a way to be happier. Here is a new way born in the wreckage of the old way.
Yeah.
You know, because again, we look those years, it's just a wonder civilization was able to rebuild. That was a horrible event.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating stuff, and you see those kind of scoundrels in Star Trek too, that are taking advantage of people like that, and then you have the Ferengi, who at first seem like they're part of that also. But what Deep Space Nine did that was kind of interesting was say, but that's their culture.
Well, yeah. You know? In The Next Generation, there is a critique. The Ferengi are a critique of capitalism.
Yeah.
And I'm not entirely sure. You're the expert. In Next Generation is when we hear clues about the economy of the future, right? Like money.
Well, it's always been very
vague. But there's references. Like Picard, I think, references like...
Only a very far off world. Like on the Federation, things are cool. What I believe the case is, and it is elliptical, there is guaranteed income because there are no slackers. You know, if you live on Earth, for example, there's guaranteed income because... But there's also plenty. There is the replicator.
And there's no resource. I mean, capitalism is a way to manage limited resources.
Right, right.
And in a future where fundamental resources are unlimited, that changes the economy.
Well, correct. But it's not quite so unlimited as you may think. So for example, there are references later in Deep Space Nine of when you're on Earth and you want to transport. Not everybody has their own personal transporter. So if you're in Pakistan, want to transport to San Diego, you got to use one of your transporter credits, you know? So
technology is rationed.
I think it's
future.
It's time management more than anything because, you know, everybody wants to go. You got to get online. You can't just transport willy-nilly. It takes up resources. So you're allowed to do it. Everybody has access to it. You just got to plan, you know, and if you need an emergency transport, I'm sure there would be a reason and they would let you cut to the front of the line. But it's not. But there are sort of elliptical references to credit systems on Earth. But in terms of food, there's plenty of food.
Right.
And in terms of jobs, everybody has a job and people advance in a particular chosen field based on, you know, their pursuits. Like, you know, it's a meritocracy, and if someone's really good at botany, they want to become the best botanist and work really, really hard and get a good job in the chief botany lab because it is the righteous thing to do. So this is a little bit of the Jewish influence because there is no afterlife in Judaism, as you know. Because believe me, one life is enough. So why lead a righteous life? Because it is righteous to do so. The cyclical thinking. It begs the question.
Well, you know, but let me, you know, I know a bit about ancient Jewish texts. Why then?
Yeah.
Near the end of the first act of Fiddler on the Roof. Does Tevye say that ghosts have visited? You know, he's trying to.
Oh, there's mysticism. Well, but that's old world. That's
how can I'm just saying. Yeah. How can there be ghosts if there's no afterlife?
All right, that's a very good question, because these were simple people. And they were not learned men. That's probably the answer. You know, all Eastern European shtetl Jews had loads of little ticks and quirks. Like they would throw salt. They would have the evil eye, the hamsa, the hand. You know, they were as much as any other. Cultures from that period that would have mysticism that is not particularly in line with the religion. But that's just the
schism. So here's my pitch for Catholicism.
That's just the schism, though, between theologians and real world.
Here's my pitch for Catholicism. When you die, you get a nice robe.
Robe, yeah.
And all the spaghetti you can eat.
It's like the Olive Garden.
And that's
all
heaven.
The salad and breadsticks.
It's like a gif. Yeah. You just sit there and you just slurp spaghetti.
Yeah.
For eternity.
Yeah, who's going to be afraid? Well, I mean, as long as there's enough sauce.
Real quickly, Ferengi are villains in Roddenberry's Star Trek Next Generation.
They were just underdeveloped, yes.
But out of the gate, the introduction, and they are a pretty, I mean, it's a pretty arch criticism of capitalism.
Yes.
In DS9, from what I can remember and from what I read, it's almost, there's an honor in their capitalism.
Yes. And this is something,
which I find fascinating, because then the question is, you know, we fetishize capitalism, but I could make an argument that we are not a meritocracy, and that due to the lack of regulation and transparency, we are not a best ascend. We're very much a status quo society. If you get yours, then and then you protect it.
The Ferengi on Deep Space Nine are, you know, people like to talk about Deep Space Nine being very rich and having a lot to sink your teeth into, and that is best exemplified by the Ferengi because there are so many different ways to approach it. First of all, they are the comic relief. When it's a Ferengi episode, it's a silly episode because they look funny. And
Wallace Shawn.
Yeah, Wallace Shawn.
I love him. He's an amazing playwright.
Yeah.
And I love that designated mourner. Amazing.
Yeah.
I love that he was a DS9 regular.
And once a season. He was on every season. That's Grand Nagus Zek. I interviewed him once.
He was on every season?
He had at least one. Yeah. I believe so.
He
showed
up. First season?
Yeah. The Grand Nagus.
I didn't even.
He was in an episode called The Nagus, and it was like they're bringing in the head Ferengi, and it's Wallace Shawn.
He's so great.
I once interviewed him in the offices of in Vanity Fair's offices at the Condé Nast Building, the old one here in New York, and he and Andre Gregory came in because they were doing something together, as they often do, and I was interviewing them, and it was for a very different part of my brain. For the, you know, the more erudite part of my brain. And I'm like, I'm not letting Wallace Shawn out of this room before I talk about his Deep Space Nine years. And so we're talking about Anton Chekhov, because they had done a Chekhov film with Jonathan Demme.
Uncle Vanya and 42nd Street.
No, he did one of that too. He revisited it recently. They did...
oh, that's right.
It was not Chekhov. It was the other guy, Ibsen. They did...
Yes, I know what you're saying. I know. I get it. I haven't seen it.
Not Doll's House. What's the famous one? The Builder.
Wild Duck. No, I know what you're talking about. I know.
The Builder. And the young people are coming, and they're very famous. It's like the most famous play in history. Come on, look it up. Just type in Ibsen play. It's the first one.
Hold on. It's not the first one, because that would be Doll's House.
All right, it's the second one.
Just give me talk. Talk while I look up.
What the point I'm making is we're talking about intelligent things. And then I'm like, I'm not going to let him out of here until I talk about the Grand Nagus.
Master Zek. Builder.
Master Builder. What did I say? Construction? The construction worker?
Yeah.
Master Builder. Yes, that great Lego movie spinoff, The Master Builder. So
it was an Ibsen reference in the Lego movie.
Yeah, yeah. So the point I'm making is we're about to wrap up the interview, and I'm like, Wallace Shawn, I want to talk a little bit about a character that you played for years on television, Grand Nagus Zek. And he said, and he has that voice. I mean, he amps it up for Inconceivable and for Grand Nagus Zek. And he says, nobody ever talks to me about Deep Space Nine, but I love doing it. And, you know, and he really had plenty of great stories to tell. You know,
Andre Gregory, right?
Yeah.
Great director.
Yeah.
Amazing guy.
Yeah.
Sometime in the 90s, I guess. Because when did Deep Space Nine happen?
In the 90s.
But when was the first episode?
93, like? I think, was the first episode, give or take.
Here's the conversation real quickly. Andre Gregory talking with Wallace Shawn. Andre Gregory. So you're doing a Star Trek TV show. Wallace Shawn, yeah, it's great. You should do something like that. Andre Gregory, to his agent, yes, I will appear in Demolition Man. And
is that true?
I believe he is briefly in Sylvester Stallone's and Wesley Snipes' amazing science fiction mid-90s movie that I saw out of my mind on LSD, and he has to be in it because I don't know why I would hallucinate Andre Gregory.
You fell asleep and thought of my dinner with Andre during.
If I'm gonna hallucinate out of my mind on LSD in the mid '90s, it's not going to be, a devotee of Grotowski.
You know, Andre Gregory also was in. He doesn't act much. You know, he's a theater director, and he's in My Dinner with Andre. He was in a great biblical film. He played John the Baptist in Martin Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ. He has like one scene.
That movie, look, I did not even know that. That all I know, but I love them. I loved Bowie as Pilot.
Right.
And I love, hey, Jesus. Hey, hey, Jesus.
Harvey Keitel is Judas Iscariot.
I love Judas as someone like, hey, son of man. I'm going to betray you
for 30 pieces of silver. We got to wrap this up, John, but I know what's fun. It's sad. When you and I were emailing, we said we would talk a lot about Riker because I know you love the character Riker. We barely talked about him.
But, we hit on him.
We got sidetracked by politics, but it's a big day. And we also didn't talk about one of your favorite movies as a kid, which has a direct Star Trek connection beyond generic, I shouldn't say generic, but just general science fiction. Patrick Stewart, before he was Picard, was in David Lynch's Dune.
Journey.
And Dune is is it a great movie?
It is a phenomenal film. You should have started the podcast about Dune, because we were talking about, you asked me about why I got into Star Trek, and I brought up formative 80s movies.
Yeah.
And Dune was a formative 80s movie for me.
Sting in a truss.
I keep in mind, you know,
a David, metal truss.
There's a rumor. I don't know if it's been substantiated, but you know, after The Elephant Man, David Lynch was a hot property, and at one point, I believe he was one of many directors considered for Return of the Jedi.
He was, yes, along with David Cronenberg.
Instead, you know, Dino De Laurentiis hooked him in to produce, you know, Frank Herbert's unfilmable sociopolitical, dream crazy book.
1,000 pages, give or take.
I love that movie because it's about David Lynch. You know, it's about nightmare penises and sand. It's about space cocaine. It's about ribbed leather. It's I would love it. I would love it for someone to get into a conversation with me about how it's a terrible movie compared to the book. I read the book. F the book. I don't care about the book. It's one of the dumbest conversations on the internet ever.
Yeah.
It's like whenever you try to write anything about Lynch's Dune, it's not as good as the book. F you and the book. No one wants to see the book. Sci-Fi Channel tried to create.
They tried, yeah. I never saw it.
It sucked. Yeah. You know what I want? I want a malevolent, levitating fat man pulling heart plugs out of twinks. I love that movie so hard. I love it, Melange. Yeah. And the fucking, what do you call it? The narration?
Yeah.
Never a drop of rain on. You know, and I'm a little kid, and my brain is being blown by this movie. It is so erotic. It is so insane. It's got
Max von Sydow.
It's got the greatest cast ever.
Max von Sydow.
Jose Ferreira and look, Mr. Ferreira, I loved you in Cyrano de Bergerac. Okay, so here's, you are an ancient space emperor. To one side, you got evil, maybe good space nuns trying to breed a galactic Jesus.
Yeah.
And what's going to come in right now in a giant tank
right.
is a malformed, I don't know.
It's a giant semen.
Just a huge maggot.
Well, it's an individual semen blown up.
Right. They're part of this guild.
Right.
That gets everybody. And in the future,
yeah.
we travel space through intense. They fold time.
Yes. Space travels us.
Thanks to sweet cocaine.
The Spacing Guild.
You know, and like, so that, like, you know, this planet, yeah. you know they're bad because the planet. Looks bad.
What was the thing?
So
you know,
I love it.
Lightsabers and phases are great, but the Dunwicky,
the force shields. Well, the so force great. Shields.
But the thing,
the slow blade penetrates the shield.
What about the weirding way, right?
Oh, my name is a killing name, Devor. I mean, but it's so.
Wait, what is the thingamajig on his wrist?
Yeah, the weirding.
It's just called the weirding device
module or something.
The weirding module. How is that not as ubiquitous as a lightsaber?
Well, because, look, it's the 80s, right? It was a very macho time. We're talking missiles and phalluses. And so we have two competing phallus icons, a glowing laser dick, right?
Yeah.
Versus Lynch's answer, which are these ribbed worm penises. And so in the penis iconography war, Star Trek wins. I was mentioning this off air. They tried when the studio got Dune, the marketing people were like, it's our Star Wars.
Yeah.
It's our Star Wars. Let's take a look at it and then let's brainstorm the merchandising. Because Lucas, we're going to make so much money. Dune, merchandising moolah.
Yeah.
After the movie, they're like, oh, fuck. All right, I guess we'll make a Paul Atreides. He's just in a black leather suit. And then there's the villain who's got black toenail polish. And then what's the big monster? Oh, the worms.
Yeah.
We'll make the worms. I begged my mom for a Dune space worm, and bless her heart, I don't know why she bought it for me. I am the man I am now because as a 9-year-old, 10, whatever, however old I was able to run around outside playing with a ribbed black dildo whose mouth opened at the end to reveal pink teeth.
Right. This was the vagina dentata and the dildo
this
all at once.
This was my most beloved toy in my space operas. Space worm trumped Rancor.
Wow.
If you was a battle between my space worm, my two most beloved
sandworm.
Yeah, sandworm, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever. Look at that.
Yeah. Oh my.
Look at that.
Sweet heavenly God.
Brian created a photo, brought up the toy.
Jesus.
I wish I had that toy.
What was your mother thinking when she bought this
toy? I was a proto Harry Potter running around casting spells with a plastic sandworm toy. I'm sure there were mothers who were like, Timmy.
Yeah. When you're done with
John is a nice little boy. But we don't hang out with little boys who play with dildos. I love that sandworm with all of my heart. And I love that movie. That movie is underrated. The design is phenomenal.
It's wonderful.
And you know what? David Lynch did his level best to cram the pageantry and royal intrigue and bizarreness of Frank Herbert's book into three practically comprehensible hours. That Toto, that score at the end. Oh, yeah. Oh, it's the best. When I die.
Yeah.
And when we get done, you pull it up.
Yeah.
Toto's final fanfare.
Yeah.
The music at the end of Dune. That is what I want played at my funeral.
Right. As you're blasted off.
It is melancholy and epic and utterly beautiful.
There are multiple cuts of Lynch's Dune.
Yeah, there's an Alan Smithy cut.
Right. Well, I don't know which cut it is. It's the longest cut. But it opens with not just narration, like Tolstoy level text of just blocks and blocks of paragraphs
with
of text.
With terrible drawings.
Yeah, with what were probably left over from the art room.
Yeah.
You know, just.
That is the Alan Smithy version.
Okay.
And so if you look at it, it's directed by Alan Smithy.
Right.
And I believe that was a version that was played on TV for a while, and it was awful. It was terrible.
It was more Dune.
I can rewatch that movie over and over. Like, I get chills when they ride the sandworm.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful.
The blue eyes. Oh, my God.
When the sandworm is called by vibration. So you bang, you thump the sand, and that is like, you know, these burly men crouching down. I mean, it's very...
It's everything. And I'll tell you, Dune is significant because it wrecked, for multiple reasons, but it really wrecked Lynch. That was his one big studio mega picture.
Yeah.
It wrecked him. He went internal. He talks about how difficult it was. And instead of succumbing to the failure, you know, he kind of went internal and then produced... his follow-up was an independent movie called Blue Velvet.
A masterpiece.
A masterpiece and a rare cinematic masterpiece because, you know, he got rejected by the studio system and created an independent movie that wasn't just a movie. It created an entire creative vocabulary for him because, you know, Blue Velvet feeds into Wild at Heart. It feeds into Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
He created a vibration, just this vibe. The Lynchian, the thing that we call Lynchian.
Starts at Blue Velvet, really.
It really does. And I don't think he would have found that if he had not crashed and burned so epically
100%,
with Dune.
100%. I mean, there are elements of it in Eraserhead.
Elements,
but,
sure.
But it was he was still creating fine art. He was not creating narrative films. And which he's doing now. Not that he's working too much these days, but his last film was also incomprehensible. But to
Inland Empire, right. But like Mulholland Drive, which I would argue is the first and only classic of the century, of the new century, is that would not have happened. That exists in the same world as Blue Velvet.
Correct. So Dune's failure reaped tremendous rewards for
and I don't even, you know, it was a box office failure.
Well, yeah.
But it was an elegant and experimental and bizarre and lovely studio blockbuster.
Yeah.
Even the structure of it, the three acts are bizarre.
And I love how
weird
they tried to spin it in the 80s as for kids, as like this is the next Star Wars, Star Trek, E.T., and then very soon, most people were like, no way. Now, you know, there are movies like this that still come out. Did you see Alex Proyas's Gods of Egypt?
Oh, I did. I went to the movie theater at 11 a.m. and saw that.
So good.
You know, I won't agree on, you know, but I will agree on Jupiter Ascending.
Is in the same ballpark. I didn't like it as much. But.
Gods of Egypt was loony, but you could see in Gods of Egypt an attempt to create Clash of the Titans,
sure,
and then it just fell apart.
Yeah,
Jupiter Ascending seemed, I mean, it's got space cops that talk to bees, it's got you know, like jets, rollers,
right,
you know,
jet rollerblades,
you know, it's got races that eat planets. It is goofy as shit. And I love it for that. But Jupiter Ascending is probably one of my favorite B movies of recent lore that I will probably watch in 5 years and be like, I love it. It's so goofy.
Well, I'm more of a Gods of Egypt man, but I do think both of those movies, which tanked, deserve better. John Carter also wasn't that bad either in that tank.
You know, somebody rewatched it and was kind to it.
Yeah.
And I might want to watch that. I just, you know, I like auteurs who are given budgets.
Well, if you consider, what's his name?
I don't.
What was the guy who did John Carter? He was an animation guy.
Yeah.
He did like Monsters, Inc. That was his thing. He went from Monsters, Inc. to... No, he went from... Andrew Stanton was his name.
He did
a lot of the Pixar movies.
I'll have to rewatch it because I loved Edgar Rice Burroughs's John Carter books as a kid.
Yeah.
I found them in a thrift store.
Right.
I was drawn the way that you should be.
Because you grew up in 1941.
I love thrift stores. I love thrift stores. But because of thrift stores, I was able to, at a young age, get hooked into lurid, shitty genre science fiction fantasy books.
My mother would never let me buy books at thrift stores because they probably had germs on them.
That's the only reason I went to thrift stores was to buy books.
Germs.
Books.
Oh, okay. Yeah, my mother was like, no, they're moldy and they smell.
Well, your mother didn't buy you a plastic nightmare penis.
And with that, we got to wrap it up. John DeVore, thanks. People can follow your work, all over the internet.
Just follow me on Twitter,
On
Jordan.
Twitter. What is your Twitter handle?
It is at John DeVore.
DeVore.
Sometimes even you and I banter.
Yeah, sometimes. Well, I hope to have you back on some other time. This was
a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. A great way to distract ourselves from the election that's happening today.
Yeah, I'm going to go and emotionally eat right now for the next 12 hours.
All right. We'll have you back on soon. And thanks again for listening. And remember to like us on Facebook and tweet at us. You can tweet me at Jay Hoffman. Use the hashtag EngagePod. Next week's episode will have more Star Trek content in it, I promise. It won't just be about current events, and we'll see you soon.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.